Welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for joining our Advanced Qualitative Methods Learning Collaborative Cyber Seminar Series. In just a while, I'm going to introduce our wonderful speaker and set up the topic for today. I just wanted to remind you, for any of you who maybe joined this particular session because you had an interest in the speaker or the topic area, we do host moderate to advanced methods talks for qualitative research every month. And we do have a fairly large collaborative. There's about 700 people from around the world that are in it. So if you did just happen to join the session and you would like to join the collaborative and receive our monthly newsletter, which has kind of articles and seminars and information about qualitative work, I will put a link in the chat after I'm finished with the introductions, and you can go ahead and use that Qualtrics link to join the collaborative if you'd like to do so. And now I would like to introduce our speaker today and the topic for today. So I'm very pleased that we have Dr. Justin Choi with us presenting today. He is a hospitalist and assistant professor of medicine in the Division of General Internal Medicine for Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City in New York. And he is a clinical educator and has a lot of interest in looking at patient safety research, particularly when it is related to diagnostic errors. So we're very pleased to have him and his expertise with us today. And so he's going to be chatting with us about this particular project that he's worked on that relates to the handoff process for overnight admissions. And in particular, he's also going to be presenting some of the methods and findings from this ethnographic work that he's undertaken. And I think that this is something that people in the collaborative have been asking to hear about for some time. Like I was just telling Justin, we tend to focus a lot of our methodology on interviews and focus groups. But this can be, observations can be a very powerful method when it's used, when it helps to meet your research question needs. So also, last thing I'll say before I turn it over to Dr. Choi is just remember, as I said, please do enter your questions at any time in the Q&A portion. We don't want you to miss anything that you might want to be asking. And that's one of the things about this series that's nice. We leave time for you to be able to have an engaging discussion with the presenter and ask him questions. So please remember to do that. You can find the Q&A using the lower three dots, the right ellipses at the bottom of your screen. So thank you again so much for joining. And now I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Choi.
Thank you, Christine. And thank you so much for the introduction and the opportunity to speak with everyone here today. I'm very excited to share some of our work and perhaps hopefully also learn and hear some feedback from the audience. So we'll get right to it. So first, to begin, I'd of course like to acknowledge those individuals who made this work possible. Brian Garibaldi is a pulmonologist and also clinician educator and researcher. He leads or has led what's called the Society of Bedside Medicine. It's a nonprofit organization and community that focuses on advancing patient-centered care through innovation and education. And he's actually now the inaugural director of the Center for Bedside Medicine at Northwestern University, which is really interesting. But he was very generous and kind enough to support and fund the work that I will share. And he also led me to two co-mentors and co-investigators, Dr. Janet Reckard and Dr. Lars Osterberg, both general internists and also clinician educators and education researchers. So thank you to them and others, and I have no conflicts of interest. Just a few objectives to structure the session today. First, I'll just briefly discuss diagnostic errors and background behind that, particularly among hospitalized adults and the emerging focus around teamwork in the diagnostic process. We'll then get into the study and share findings of our study, which will focus on academic ward teams in diagnostic processes for hospitalized adults. And in that study, we use ethnographic methods. And at the end, I'd like to just reflect on ethnographic approaches to studying medical ward teams and perhaps generate some questions to consider around that. A little disclaimer about me, if you will, and I realize I'm speaking to an audience of quite experienced qualitative researchers. I am not, and I do not claim to be any sort of quote-unquote card-carrying qualitative researcher. I do have a Master's of Science in Clinical and Translational Investigation, through which I gained some training in various aspects of clinical research, primarily biostatistics and clinical epidemiology, but also qualitative research methods. But I would say the most of my so-called training and experience have come from collaborating and working with various mentors, experienced researchers in qualitative research. So in addition to Janet and Lars I mentioned earlier, I've been fortunate enough to find mentors in other disciplines, particularly cognitive psychology, as again, my interest is around diagnostic errors and sort of the thinking that goes into that. And so I'd also just like to acknowledge all my various mentors who have helped me along this way. Okay, so first for some context of the study. This report might be familiar to some. It was published in 1999 by the Institute of Medicine called To Err Is Human. And it really brought attention to the pervasive problem we have in healthcare, which is medical errors. And it identified upwards of nearly 100,000 deaths per year in the United States, which is a pretty shocking number. But up until this point, medical errors were more or less a blind spot in healthcare. And it wasn't until this report that there was a lot of attention paid towards medical errors. And with that, of course, funding and institutes that have supported work in this area. But it's interesting to note that in this initial report, while they talk about a range of different medical errors, diagnostic errors was not mentioned at all. There had been some work around diagnostic errors in the early 1990s and through the decade, but it really wasn't an area of focus. And, you know, sure enough, over the next decade or so, a lot of researchers identified that as a significant gap. And David Newman-Toker and Peter Pronovost, one of the two of the leaders in diagnostic error research, called for more attention towards diagnostic errors. So the Institute of Medicine, which then became the National Academy of Medicine, generated a new report in 2015 that specifically focused on improving diagnosis in healthcare. And within the report, they looked at teamwork, and they noted that while teamwork had been investigated in other areas of healthcare, it really didn't receive the same attention in the diagnostic process. So in the report, this expert committee outlined several goals and recommendations to move the field forward. And their top goal was actually to look at teamwork in the diagnostic process and how can we better facilitate teamwork among health professionals, patients, and their families. So more and more, we're increasingly recognizing the importance of teamwork in diagnosis. And as a clinician and hospital medicine physician, that is largely what we do day to day, is we work in teams. And this is a picture in our institution of what a typical ward team rounds would look like. And this has been a heavy focus in my both educational efforts and also now research efforts, is examining the processes involved and from that, what can we learn and how can we improve? So, of course, just like in any domain, there are a number of challenges. And I would say teamwork in the ward setting is particularly challenging on a number of levels, but I'll just mention two that are relevant to our study. So one is the sort of frequent handoffs and transitions of care that happen in the hospital. And you can look at it at a number of levels. You can look at it from the patient perspective when they move from the emergency room to the hospital ward, and then, maybe they're discharged and move towards the outpatient setting. So those are each transitions of care. And then in any one of those settings, there are team transitions. Teams do not spend a whole lot of time together, at most maybe 2 or 4 weeks. Sometimes it can be as short as a day. And so how does that all come together safely and effectively for patient care? And in my area of focus, in diagnostic safety. So we know that these transitions of care are prone to errors, including diagnostic errors. And there are various reports that estimate a high burden of serious harms that come from it, up to 80% in some cited studies. But one particular transition of care that hasn't been a heavy focus just yet is the patients that are admitted overnight and then handed off the next morning to the day team. And this is an everyday occurrence in hospital medicine, is typically we receive at least two, three, sometimes four or five patients overnight. They're admitted by one team, and then there's a transition of care that happens the following morning. So just to, I guess, depict this in cartoon form, the patient who's presenting to the emergency room is seen by the emergency team, and there's a decision to admit for some of those patients. The patients who are admitted overnight are admitted by, in a teaching hospital setting, a night float resident, who then, after deciding the initial plan of care, will hand off the patient the following morning to the day ward team members, who will continue taking care of the patient for the subsequent days. So our transition of care and handoff focus was what is happening on morning rounds between this transition, in this transition between the night and day teams. So morning rounds or attending rounds, you'll hear various names for this team activity, has been investigated. And this was a great study done, I guess, over a decade ago in multiple teaching hospitals where investigators joined rounds, observed, and documented what was happening. What kind of activities are teams spending their time on, and so forth. And, some of their primary findings were that there was a lot of time around electronic health record and computers and around treatment decisions, less on diagnostic inquiry, patient communication, unfortunately, and actually a shift from activities away from the bedside into hallways or charting rooms, like we see in the picture there. So what this study did a great job of sort of describing what is happening, but not yet examining the how and even why of what is done during morning rounds. So we felt that this was an opportunity to describe really how it is that ward teams operate in the handoff process of patients admitted overnight during these ward rounds, and also to characterize the role of the bedside patient evaluation in the diagnostic process. So our study, you can find in the Journal of General Internal Medicine if you'd like to explore that further. But we'll go over some of the highlights here. So, as far as our sort of theoretical framing of how we approached this topic area, there's in the psychology literature a family of social cognitive theories called situativity theory, which has been used previously by others to study the diagnostic process. But essentially, it's describing this complex phenomenon of our judgments and thinking and decision making being influenced by not just what's happening within individuals and their internal workings and thinking, but is very much dependent on everything around them, interactions with the teams, particular moderating factors with the patient and the environment. And so this is all to say that without going into heavy detail into the theory, is that we wanted to consider not just this sort of clinical diagnostic process of putting together signs and symptoms towards a working diagnosis, but what are all the factors in the environment and interactions with other team members that influence that? And for those who are not familiar with the diagnostic process, I thought I would just briefly share kind of how it is conceptualized, because this was sort of at the center of what we wanted to try to observe. So diagnosis happens over time, of course, and it evolves as the patient's illness evolves and as new information comes in. But essentially, there are different stages or phases of the diagnostic process. And so, for example, the patient who's experiencing a health problem has to engage the healthcare system. Then they meet the clinician, and the clinician will engage in history taking, physical examination, diagnostic testing, referrals and consultations at times. And with all that data, somehow integrating and interpreting it towards a differential diagnosis, working diagnosis. And then once you have a working diagnosis, that then informs how you act. So perhaps there are some treatment decisions on the back end, and also communicating with the patients in terms of explaining what might be going on. So this is very intuitive to clinicians, but just to map it out for those who are not as familiar with the diagnostic process. Okay, so with all that background, now getting into the study. So we chose a qualitative study using ethnographic methods, and qualitative study because really our question was around how teams are handing off patients from night to day, and not necessarily, trying to correlate or quantify various aspects with outcomes like diagnostic errors. That might come in a future study, but first we wanted to get a better sense of how this is all happening. So we performed non-participant field observations of various ward team rounds and handoffs. And the data collected included field notes from those field observations and also document review through the electronic health record to provide better context around the handoff. Many might be noticing that what's absent is interviewing the participants, and we decided for feasibility and constraints on time and perhaps a little bit of institutional culture that it was best to not try to do interviews as part of this study. And we can talk and reflect definitely more on that decision, but we strictly stuck with structured field observations and document review for our data collection and analysis. And this, how it looked was myself as the non-participant observer would sit on rounds or follow teams wherever they went during morning rounds with a notepad and a pen, and took notes and jottings of what was happening, informed by, prior knowledge around the diagnostic process. And given that I am a hospitalist clinician, already an understanding of how team rounds already looks. So in that sense, was already attuned to some of the details we wanted to pick up, but also tried to remain open-minded and just simply document everything that I could observe. So this was both in charting rooms during team discussions and also at the bedside with patients. This field observation typically took 2 to 3 hours on a given day in the morning. And then immediately afterwards, what I did was I went to the computer and blocked off the remaining day to transcribe all of what I had written down on pen and paper into Word documents so that we could later analyze it. And this actually took longer than the field observations, if you can believe that, because it involved, the field notes was a lot of shorthand and jottings and not fully formed observations. And so that in itself required time. And then also going into the electronic health record to provide more context around what was going on with the patient, what the team was thinking, and enhancing the data collected in that way. So that was another 2 or 3 hours at the computer. Where I did this was at my home institution here in New York City, New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell, over a 3 month period, now 2 years ago. This is a academic medical center and teaching hospital, a single site. We have seven general medicine ward teams that typically spend either 2 or 4 weeks working together. Each team will have one attending senior physician, and then residents and interns, a total of four residents and interns at various postgraduate years, usually one or two medical students. And then in the morning, that one rotating night float resident. The night float resident actually would change kind of day to day, but the day team that you'll see above here were the ones that remained together for 2 to 4 weeks. So I'll get to how many teams we followed and all that. Mentioning a little bit about how we analyzed it. So after de-identifying and transcribing all the field notes and relevant chart review data into Word and Excel, we then conducted thematic analysis using an inductive approach. And this I did in concert with my co-investigators, Dr. Reckert and Dr. Osterberg. And it was a we spent quite a bit of time on this. So first, Janet and Lars, especially because they were not observing, we all immersed ourselves in the data, read it several times over before we did any sort of coding. Then we each independently, the three of us, coded what was in the data without any a priori coding framework, so to speak. But knowing that we wanted to code around the research objective, which was to better understand the teamwork process in this handoff on morning rounds and consideration of the diagnostic process. So we did an initial round of coding, then several other later rounds of coding, iteratively changing codes, refining codes. Then going back to the original data with our revised coding framework. Eventually, we moved towards developing larger categories of codes and identifying themes. And at each stage, we all did this independently and then met in meetings to compare, reflect, achieve consensus around the various codes, categories, and themes until we felt that we really had adequate data to support the final themes we generated. At the same time, along with this thematic analysis, we also just wanted to provide a descriptive picture of rounds. So we quantified some of the observational data, various characteristics of the handoff process, and also various aspects of the diagnostic process. And we'll get to that here. So as far as results, as a general summary, we observed five different ward teams that included 29 different team members on the day team side and 16 different night float residents. And the sample, although I didn't mention this earlier in the methods, we purposefully sampled based on the attending physician leading the rounds, and we wanted to capture a range of clinical experience. So, as you can see, some early, more junior faculty attendings to very experienced attendings at 10 and 21 years. So, across the five teams, we observed 30 handoffs of patients admitted overnight to general medicine services. This amounted to about 35 hours of field observations. As far as various activities during these ward rounds, so the oral presentation, so typically the night float resident who admitted the patient is presenting the patient to the day team in the form of an oral case presentation. So the entirety of that oral case presentation, the median time was 12.5 minutes. And you can see the team spent more time presenting and discussing cases than they did with patients themselves, which is captured by the duration of the bedside evaluation. At our institution, the oral presentation and discussions happen separate from the bedside evaluation. And I know this aspect actually varies from hospital to hospital. hospital to hospital. Some places might combine the two and do both the case discussion and bedside evaluation together, but here they are different activities. So patients are spending more time in the charting room, talking about patients than they are seeing patients. And then you'll also notice, as far as the number of patients, that not every patient was seen by the team at the bedside. So of the 30 handoffs we saw, only 20 instances did the whole team, with all the team members, go see the patient together. And then within the bedside evaluation encounters, physical examination as part of the diagnostic process, spending 2 minutes as a median time, and a range around that. Sometimes a physical examination was not done. So this gives us a sense of perhaps where teams are prioritizing their time and activities. During the bedside evaluations, we found that the day team that were receiving the patient from the admitting night flow resident, didn't spend a whole lot of time verifying the initial symptoms and even the initial physical examination findings that were reported. There was a heavier emphasis on either diagnostic tests and certainly on management decisions like treatments. On average, one of every three symptoms that the patient reported was followed up and verified by the ward team at the bedside. And even fewer physical examination findings were verified by the day team. We noticed that diagnostic reasoning and discussion around things like a differential diagnosis received far less attention during these team discussions than other aspects of patient care. So, for example, a differential diagnosis, which is communicating sort of the various possibilities of what might be explaining the presenting illness or presenting problem, was discussed in less than a third of patients. And as mentioned, in about a third of patients, two-thirds of patients, or 20 times, the patients went to the bedside. And in those bedside encounters, there was not a whole lot of emphasis around diagnosis. Only on eight occasions was the working diagnosis explicitly communicated between the team and the patient, and even fewer was there a discussion around alternative explanations or a differential diagnosis. So immediately following the bedside encounter, we followed teams, and what ended up happening was, among the teams that saw the patient together at the bedside, one of every five patients, or 20% of those instances, there was a meaningful and significant change in the differential diagnosis, which suggests that going to see the patient together at the bedside can have an impact on what the diagnostic thinking is in the case. Okay, so transitioning from more of the descriptive parts of the analysis to the thematic analysis, we identified three major themes, which we'll go through. So the first theme was the priority that bedside evaluations receive. The second theme, team coordination and communication during that bedside evaluation and bedside encounter. And then a third theme of team debriefings for the purposes of teaching and also performance in diagnosis. So, priority of bedside evaluations, we observed and inferred that bedside evaluations received lower priority than other clinical tasks. And so, as we presented earlier, the bedside evaluation was performed less frequently than other activities on rounds. And also, it was uniformly performed at the end of rounds. And part of why teams didn't get a chance to see every patient together is they simply ran out of time given the time constraints on rounds. So perhaps that suggests that there's a lower priority for bedside evaluations if we assume that the activities that teams are spending the most time on and the most frequently and at the start of rounds are going to be the ones that receive the most priority. major diagnostic elements, process elements like the bedside evaluation, and including things like history taking and physical examination, received less engagement from other ward team members during the morning ward rounds. So during case discussions, we frequently saw observed that team members appeared distracted either by their phones or computers. And even, to be frank, disinterested in terms of hearing about the history and exam based on nonverbal observations. Also, there was a number of occurrences where there was explicit instruction from the seniors to skip over the history and exam parts of the presentation and get to the assessment and get to the plan for the patient. The second theme of team coordination and communication and bedside evaluations, we observed ward teams performing very key coordinated efforts during the physical exam. So, for example, preparing the patient and the room for the physical examination. You know, part of the physical exam is making sure we respect patients' comfort and also privacy. And in the hospital setting where often they're boarding in the same room with other patients. There's a hallway with people walking by. There's a bit of preparation involved. And so the team dynamic during that physical examination was you had various team members helping the patient, you know, sitting them up in bed, putting a gown over their legs, while other team members at the same time would go to the door and close the door or pull the curtain. And all of this was done not implicitly and without any explicit instruction. So it suggests that there is quite a bit of team coordination involved in the physical examination. And also in terms of effectively and safely performing the maneuvers. So there were many instances where one person would be doing an performing an exam maneuver while another team member was monitoring that exam maneuver and either providing feedback or adjusting the specific maneuver in a way that either gave them a more effective physical exam performance and sometimes even for safety aspects. One common exam maneuver, which was gait assessment or getting the patient out of bed and walking them to observe their gait, this universally required multiple team members of helping the patient up, having several team members around the patient to ensure that they wouldn't fall to the ground and things like that. So there was a lot of team communication and coordination around that. And then feedback during the examination, there was a lot of feedback in those moments, which was helpful both for performing the maneuver, but also perhaps for teaching learners about how to perform physical exams. And then finally, the third theme, team debriefings for teaching and performance. So debriefings in general are actually a very powerful team activity that's supported by the evidence across disciplines in terms of improving team performance. And evidence has consistently shown that when teams debrief and reflect together, that their future performance improves. And we saw a few ward teams doing the same. So after bedside evaluations and encounters, some teams would have a purposeful huddle and debrief, reflecting on what happened at the bedside and what their assessment might be and how they might revise it going forward. And in this, we found that the differential diagnosis changed again for one of every five patients when this was happening. So a specific example here was a team that after leaving the emergency room where the patient was, they huddled together, debriefed about the bedside visit. And several members engaged in a conversation around the physical exam and hearing fine Velcro crackles, which raised a suspicion for interstitial lung disease rather than the working diagnosis of a pneumonia. And so that then informed next diagnostic steps to work up parenchymal interstitial lung disease. Team debriefings also informed not just diagnostic assessments, but assessing the severity or urgency of a clinical problem. So this was an example of a team after finding on physical exam skin cellulitis. And in the end, it was more severe and more profound than was initially presented to them in the charting room by the NIFLO resident. So there was an explicit remark by the attending physician that they were impressed by the extent of the cellulitis. And before this, they had been thinking the patient might be ready for discharge that day, but after seeing the cellulitis, they first wanted to see marked improvement before planning discharge. Again, all based on that morning bedside evaluation together as a team. So team debriefings after bedside encounters also basically offered opportunities for reflection, updates in their clinical reasoning, revisions in their decision making, and feedback, especially to learners about how to improve future performance. And again, this was something that, when it happened, was a great thing to see, but did not happen consistently with every ward team. So with all of that, we perhaps took away a few lessons that we learned and offered a few recommendations for ward teams in this kind of setting for the purpose of that handoff between overnight admissions to the day team. So the first is perhaps we need to better prioritize bedside evaluations in the morning rounds. As we saw, it can impact the differential diagnosis and the management plan for that day. It's perhaps a bit cultural that we're leaving bedside evaluations to the last moment, but perhaps a more deliberate emphasis on bedside evaluations would lead to better patient care and also better learning for our team members. The second lesson and recommendation was to engage all team members throughout the diagnostic process, including the history and exam. We know from other studies that up to 90% of diagnoses can be made on history and exam alone. And I think in this increasingly technologically advanced environment, we are relying less on history and exam. But this is often one of the sources of diagnostic errors is when history and exam components are overlooked. So a recommendation to engage the whole team throughout this process. And then the third is to perform team debriefings, especially when there are transitions of care and various team members needing to get on the same page. We observe to be a powerful technique for improving diagnosis and also ward team performance. Okay, so I thought I would conclude after sharing our study with a little bit of reflection, and particularly with the methods we used. And the question is sort of, was this ethnography in name only? And not actually ethnography. And I'm curious if anyone has any comments or questions or ideas around this. But, what is ethnography? So, and I'm all certain there are individuals in this Zoom room that know more about this than I do. But, at a simple level, ethnography is a methodology that originates from the field of anthropology and really involves in-depth study of people and cultures in their natural environments. And this requires immersion and long-term observation to really understand social meanings and interactions, behaviors, and cultural dynamics behind the activity or behavior you're studying. So, I would argue we did not do that. And in fact, true ethnography really requires, oftentimes over a year, 2 years of long-term observation. And often the observers are participants in that environment. And of course, speaking to the individuals and really getting deeper into underlying meanings. So that I would argue is more ethnography as a methodology, which again refers to the entire approach guiding this research approach, and including the philosophical framework. So it includes the theoretical grounding, the consideration of epistemological assumptions, and getting really thick descriptions of the phenomenon that you're studying. Ethnography as a method perhaps refers more to the specific techniques or tools used for data collection, mainly in the form of field observations. And, this might include observing, but also interviewing and taking field notes, and is perhaps a subset of ethnography within a broader research design. So there is this sort of debate between is ethnography methodology or method, and this is perhaps a in table form comparing and contrasting the two viewpoints. So in considering ethnography as a methodology, again, it's this sort of philosophical approach guiding the research design, theoretical frameworks, and interpretation of the data. Ethnography as a method, more of a data collection technique. True ethnography really requires thick descriptions and in-depth interpretation that seeks to understand cultural meaning and social patterns in great depth, whereas using an ethnographic method of field observations can also just focus on descriptive aspects of observable behaviors and interactions. Theoretical engagement, really incorporating theories from anthropology, sociology, and other social sciences, leans more towards ethnography as a methodology. Ethnographic methods can stand alone as a method. And then the researcher's role, research positionality and reflexivity are very much key components of ethnography as a methodology. And then, conducting field observations as an ethnographic method, oftentimes we see that as a neutral observer that has either can have a passive or active role, but there's less emphasis on positionality. So there has been a rise of ethnographic methods in healthcare. This was a systematic review that summarized all that literature a number of years ago that you might be interested in reading more about. But as it pertains to my area of interest in around diagnostic errors, focused ethnography or ethnographic methods like field observations are being increasingly used. And this is a nice little editorial that explains the reason and need for focused ethnography to study the complex phenomenon that is diagnosis and diagnostic errors. So there is a debate, I suppose, in terms of what really constitutes ethnography. You have purists who can argue that studies labeled as ethnographic are better, perhaps better described as structured observations and descriptive studies than ethnographic studies. Perhaps more pragmatic viewpoint is that because healthcare is such a dynamic and rapidly changing and fast environment, that ethnographic methods can be adapted to meet the needs of the researcher without losing value. In the end, does it really matter? You can consider these questions. Is there a threat to undermining trust in the findings if there's mislabeling of what are more observational studies using ethnographic methods as ethnography? Does misrepresenting the methods lead to oversimplified interpretations of complex healthcare processes? My viewpoint is that there's probably a continuum, and really the more important thing and the art of research, so to speak, is really matching the appropriate methodology or method to the research question and the goals of the research. So there are certainly research questions for which you would require more in-depth long-term observation, and whereas others you could perhaps use a more rapid, focused, structured observational approach. So just to recap, we discussed diagnostic errors a little bit in the hospital setting and this emerging focus on teamwork in the diagnostic process, shared our study behind war team handoffs, and what is happening as relates to diagnosis among hospitalized adults. And then at the end, reflecting a little bit on various ethnographic approaches to studying not just war teams in diagnosis, but really can be used to study any complex phenomena in healthcare. So with that, I will pause and happy to take any questions or comments and feedback.
Thank you so much for the wonderful presentation. This was a wonderful summary. I really appreciate it. We do have a few questions that I will go ahead and read out. And just wanted to also mention to the rest of the audience, please feel free to type any questions that you may have in. We have some nice time now to discuss these. So, I'm gonna go to the second question first. So, this person writes in, although thoughts and reflections on the influence of the observer on the behavior of the ward teams, i.e., ward teams being on their best behavior with an observer present, any thoughts on that, essentially? And then they go on to say, with ethnographic PO, you might be wary of how one's presence may shift or alter the normative behavior of whatever group you might be engaged with and take efforts to minimize one.
So, yeah, certainly a great question and important consideration. So first, in terms of whether the observer has an influence on behavior among the people you're observing, I've seen literature arguing in both directions. One, that there is this sort of, I think, what's called a Hawthorne effect, that participant behavior is influenced by someone watching them. But then other studies that have maybe debunked that notion. My impression is that my presence was mitigated by a few things. So one was I really tried to be a passive observer and non-intrusive. And I think that was also a part of the reason why I didn't go and pull people aside and interview them and bring attention to my presence, and that I'm watching for these things and asking about things. I think that might have attuned the participants as far as what I'm sort of observing for. So I feel like perhaps, people just forgot I was in the room because they're so busy and perhaps distracted by what else is going around them. The other consideration is that I am a part of this environment as, a hospitalist, and it's not as if this is someone who's not familiar to them is joining rounds and, oh, what are they doing? And we do have this culture here at our institution of shadowing rounds, whether it's for feedback to the attending physician, introducing new faculty to the service and how it operates. So it's actually not uncommon for there to be an observer on round. So while I don't definitively know, and it's quite possible that my presence did influence behavior, it might also have not. And also, I would say that some of what we observed, or a lot of what we took away from the study, were areas of need for improvement. So if you think about it from that perspective, that we found areas that could potentially be improved, then you can imagine that if for some reason their behavior was on their they were on their best behavior, that even then we still found some opportunities to improve the diagnostic process. So but yes, a very important question that we had to grapple with.
Yes, very good. Thank you. And I'll just say as a quick aside that in the qualitative collaborative, we receive this question a lot. And I was talking with Justin before we started that I've worked on observations. I've worked on hand hygiene observations. And we talk about this in the collaborative, and we very much find it not to be true that basically there is no research to show that that does happen, that people change their behavior, even watching like hand hygiene with us knowing that they were there. There were very many times when they just didn't use any hand hygiene. And so I think that that tends to be a common critique that doesn't really pan out when you're actually doing these types of research. So it certainly shouldn't be a reason not to use these types of methods. I would say that is definitely true. So looking at some of the other questions, and this one is see, so just thank you for there's a lot of comments on how great this was, and thank you for this thoughtful discussion. Curious to hear more about what's next for you. What research methods might people also want to use next, kind of to better understand the findings that you presented around handoffs?
Yes, so that is something we are thinking through at the moment, and I think certainly moving towards some sort of quantitative study to the begin putting how frequent are some of the issues we found, and are they in fact correlated or associated with outcomes such as diagnostic errors or mishaps, etc. So, that we're thinking through how to operationalize that. That's a larger undertaking in many aspects. And then the other consideration is, applying this and developing an intervention to improve one of the aspects that we identified. And I think one low-hanging fruit is the team debriefings, and we saw the role it can have in improving diagnostic reasoning. And so with the various stakeholders, can we design and implement an intervention to help improve conducting team debriefings during morning ward rounds? So yeah, I think the next step is certainly moving from this qualitative ethnographic work towards either a more quantitative analysis and or an intervention. So, yeah.
Very good. So, this next comment is, as a clinician scientist myself, I can't help but think about some of the missing pieces in this story. For example, some attendings review the admission history and physical before rounds. So it seems it could be natural for them to ask trainees to skip the history and physical. I'm sure you, this is what it says. I'm sure you thought about this issue as you wrote this up. How do you balance what you already know as a clinician, i.e., the variations in handoffs that you have experienced as a clinician, with what you viewed as a researcher?
Yes, a wonderful question. And what comes to mind is one of the, and actually this might be a sort of next study or next step in research, but it's actually very fundamental, which is what is the purpose of these morning rounds and this handoff between night to day, especially given the fact that, as was mentioned, the day team members, including the senior physician, have already reviewed the case and all the data. And you're absolutely right that this skipping over the history and exam might be a manifestation of having already reviewed that. So it perhaps begs the question is, what is the purpose of rounds? Is it to conduct diagnostic reasoning? Perhaps not, as perhaps shown by the data. Is it to teach? We didn't see a whole lot of explicit. I didn't really cover some of the findings we had on that aspect, but there's more emphasis on getting through the work, discussing the plan, putting in the orders, and then at the end, let's go see the patient really quickly, and maybe we talk about a few things. So I think what's interesting is that in teaching hospitals, we've been conducting ward rounds for the most part in the same way for many decades. And maybe it's time for a change given, how our environment has changed and processes have changed. So, including the attending already reviewing the record before anyone has seen the patient. So I think it's a great question. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. So the next question is, what were the limitations and or risks, if you can think of any, of using ethnography as a method in your study?
Yeah, so I take, as I'm hearing the question, ethnography as a method, so meaning using field observations to collect the data, et cetera, rather than conducting true ethnography, as I mentioned. So yeah, I think the biggest limitation was not being able to get even deeper as far as the meaning behind all this. And actually, maybe that relates to what I said earlier as far as what's the purpose of rounds. What is the meaning of the history and exam being skipped over both implicitly and explicitly? And so, I would imagine that ethnography as a methodology and, interviewing team members and participating in that environment, so to speak, and getting rich description of that social behavior would lead into deeper insights behind that. So, our approach lended more towards descriptive findings and a little, identifying a few major themes, but certainly could go a lot deeper as far as the why of what happened during rounds. Yeah, I think that's the biggest limitation. Risk. Yeah, not, I mean. Yeah, I think I'll just leave it at that. Yeah.
Very good. So, another question that just came in. What are your thoughts about having only one observer? Was that perhaps a limitation since you could have had someone else there to maybe kind of corroborate some of the findings? What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly having two independent observers and the notion of inter-rater agreement to really get a sense of what was truly happening could perhaps enhance it. It of course comes with limitations in terms of time and resources and also the constraints of the environment. It was already it's a full team in a room, and having another person, believe it or not, might have been over the tipping point in terms of how much space there was. But yeah, I think there are pros and cons to one versus more than one observer. Yeah, and also with the second observer, which we have thought about, I think that would also require a bit of training and bringing them up to speed in terms of how to conduct these field observations. So, replicability, of course, is an issue. That's probably a limitation as well, as if all these field observations were conducted by one person, myself, how replicable is that to the next setting? That's definitely up for debate.
Yeah, very good. Thank you so much. Those are the only questions in the Q&A. Whitney, I saw your comment that some people had put questions in the chat. I know we only have time for one more question, if that. I just want to make sure because I can't see those. Were there any questions that I missed that?
There's quite a few in the chat. Yeah, so I'll just read one out that I see right here. How long did it take to code and analyze results with your three-person team?
Yeah, I would say 3 to 4 months. We did the study in the fall. I did the field observations fall 2022, and we were analyzing into early 2023, then submitted the work. Yeah, so I think perhaps 3 months. Meetings were occurring roughly every 2 weeks over 3 months. Time for us in between to go back to the data and code and then come back together. But yeah, that was all, just personally and anecdotally, those were really rich sessions for me as far as discussing the content with fellow clinician educators interested in this topic. And we had a lot of great discussions around in this area. So that was fun.
And then the second part to that is there anything you would do differently next time?
Yeah, I think audio recording the team discussions, and I know that would come with more ethical considerations and approval and resources to transcribe. But I feel like if we were able to get full transcripts of what was said on rounds, we could then get towards really quantifying occurrences of some of the things that were happening. So that was one thing to consider is if I'm not interviewing, could we audio record and capture things more comprehensively, just more than just observing? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you so much. And I know it sounds like there may be a few more questions in the chat. I apologize to those who typed those in that we couldn't see them because they weren't in Q&A. And I'm sorry that we didn't get a chance to get to those. But thank you so much to the audience for being so engaged and giving such thoughtful questions. And thank you, Dr. Choi, for sharing his amazing work with us. This really was impressive. I'm so happy to have this, and it's been recorded, and now I can point the people to watch this too when they have questions about this particular method. And I hope it encourages more people to use this type of methodology because I feel like it is such a very rich and important method. So thank you so much. Dr. Choi, do you have any closing remarks you wanted to make before we end the webinar?
Just thank you so much. Really enjoyed speaking with you all today. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so very much. And then Whitney, we'll just mention a brief survey that we have for those attending, and we'll close out.
Great. Thank you, Christina, and thank you again, Dr. Choi. To our attendees, when I close the meeting, you'll be prompted with a feedback form. Please take a few moments to complete the form. We really do appreciate and count on your feedback to continue to deliver high-quality cyber seminars. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's HSR Cyber Seminar, and we look forward to seeing you at a future session. Have a great day, everyone. Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you, Christina, Whitney. Take care.
Thank you.